don't get me or misunderstand me when I say, you know, 4 to 5 properties is going to set you up. It's 4 to 5 of the right properties in the right market that meets your, that has the potential to meet your property goals, right? And and that's where most people mess up right from the start. They don't even have the right properties in the right markets. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore. We're back. Whiskey Wednesday.
Yes, sir.
Jake Sheehy. We've been doing a couple events the last few weekends.
Man, we've been booked and busy, man. If you're not a part of these, then you're missing out. I mean, some fun things have been happening. Yeah. We just had Boardroom HQ.
Boardroom HQ, where we dove in on Friday. Yeah. Got to hang out with a group of, you know, and dive in, group of investors diving into acquisitions and all that stuff. A lot of fun.
Amazing stuff. Thank you, Jeff, for coming out, sponsoring Jeff the lunch. Chisholm. Thank you for the members that flew out. I hope you guys had a great time. Nice meeting all of you.
Yeah.
Great stuff. I mean, get involved. We have more coming up in the few months. Right. So if you want to join, support@vodacy.com, hit us up.
Yeah, hit us up. Great stuff. Absolutely. The events have been a lot of fun, actually. Lots of good networking. Mm-hmm. Amazing to be able to kind of surround yourself with other people doing the same things, like-minded investors. Mm-hmm. You know, there is power in proximity. Get around people doing, you know, doing what you want to do, maybe a few steps ahead of you, but also just in that same world and mindset of saying, hey, listen, I'm trying to grow something bigger and live the life we don't want to take a vacation from. So get around other people, try and do the same. It's kind of nice, right?
I love it. Absolutely. Support@vodacy.com. Come join. Come be a part of this. Yeah. We have a school question we got to answer, but we're talking about scaling today. The title of this is Multi-Property Millionaire, The Truth to Scaling Short-Term Rentals. We're going to talk about how to scale that portfolio. Fantastic stuff. But first, we got a school question, somebody, or a support question. Let's read it off. What would make you decline a reservation? If you notice someone booked your property, but they don't have good reviews, would you decline them? Short and sweet.
Yeah, I would. I'd read the reviews. If they have multiple bad reviews and it seems like it's a habit or a problem, you know, or you can judge whether you think it's an isolated incident. Like, is there something that happened? Look at both responses. Look at kind of go see what was said about them, how they responded. But if you've got, I mean, there are some guests that have, you know, kind of a rap sheet of bad reviews. It's, when you have more than one, it's likely you're not a very good guest. And so, like we have Instant Book on a lot of our properties, but one of the things is they've got to have good reviews.
Okay.
Yep. So if they have bad reviews, we make sure that the Instant Book is something that we will decline and probably, you know, live to fight another day and not have that guest through our property. Now, Airbnb, Vrbo, they don't like that, right? Mm-hmm. They want to, if somebody wants to stay in the property, they want us to accommodate as much as possible. So I think you have to use your best judgment on what it is that you're declining over. But if they have bad reviews, and especially if they have multiple bad reviews and you don't feel like it's a one-off or you don't feel like it's an isolated incident or something happened, I would definitely consider canceling on that reservation. But you really have to look at it and try to understand both sides of a story. There's always two sides to every story, but if there is a pattern of behavior, don't assume that it's going to be any different when they show up to your property.
Now, what about like property managers? What if you're not managing, you're not self-managing? Do you think a property manager would kind of take that risk?
Yeah. I think that they're going to do the same thing we're going to do. They're going to say, hey, listen, I don't know if I want to take that risk. I mean, if the guest reviews and the platform on the guest, like as a host and a guest, we obviously get rated and reviewed. If they have multiple bad reviews, most property managers are probably steering clear as well.
Okay. Love it. All right, let's go into scaling. We're going to talk about location, biggest struggles, biggest payoffs, why some people scale, why some don't, how much work is this going to take, self-managing, realistic timelines. And then we got some speed round questions. So let's get into it. All right, so let's go into this. We've recently went to Tampa. I'm sure you guys have heard. We saw one of our amazing members, Dan and Claudia Gorman. They did some amazing stuff. Properties, I'm sure, link in the bio. I'll put them there. And they doubled down on a location.
Right.
Right. And we're here at our Boardroom HQ. One of the questions was, you know, they built this college town Airbnb and it's going great. But now they're thinking, should we double down in this area or should we go somewhere else?
Yeah.
So let's talk about the location, the risk of doubling down in one area, or if that's a benefit.
Yeah. We were talking with Alex and Katie, where they've got a property in Eugene, Oregon, mm-hmm. and they're saying, you know, we're ready for really number two. What is the smartest and best way when it comes to scaling? And obviously as investors, a lot of times that is, we have to scale this portfolio. We have to get multiple properties. Now we're not in the business where we need hundreds of doors, right? We're trying to get really the smallest number of properties with the highest output, right? It is an asset class that you can maximize with a smaller number of doors, but usually 4 to 5 doors is going to be where a lot of people try to scale to try to make a significant financial impact and dent with being able to have some options on maybe quitting jobs, maybe covering all of our bills, being financially free, all those different things that we talk about. A lot of times in short-term rentals, that tipping point is somewhere around that 4 to 5 properties. And so Alex and Katie were talking and they're saying, hey, listen, should we, what do you think about going to different markets? And there's pros and cons to both, right? And to sticking in a market. Now there's economies of scale with management, with your boots on the ground relationships, with all of those different people that you're very familiar with. You understand the market because you already maybe have a producing property in that market. So there's a lot of benefits to sticking in one market. There's also some drawbacks with diversification. What if there's a storm, a major storm that hits, or something happens in the area? The seasonality is all the same. So there's some of those things that you're not as diversified and maybe not as insulated to any sort of a natural disaster. And so when you have properties that are all over the place, you've got different seasonality, you've got different, you know, different exposure to weather events and things like that. And so, you know, there's more diversification there, but now you got to build and have boots on the ground partners in every single one of those areas, right? In order to scale. And so normally, when somebody is like really getting after it and wanting to scale fast, it's much smoother of a process to stick in one area, right? So if you've got a decent amount of capital and you want to deploy and you want to scale that portfolio, many times you can do that faster and more efficiently in the same area because you build that one centralized team, then you don't have to do that on every single property that you're acquiring. Now, if I decide I want to be in multiple properties, at that step, I have to go build and develop those relationships with our finance partner, our realtor partners and our management partners and the boots on the ground cleaning and maintenance, all that kind of stuff, right? So we're going to have to build that every single market that we go into. And so I personally like being diversified and have properties in multiple markets. These are very much lifestyle assets for us as well. And so I don't want to have 4 homes in one market because I only want to use one home in one market. So we go around. But that doesn't mean that's the right way to do it. There are benefits and pros and cons to both, and you can absolutely make scaling work whether you double down in one area or whether you want to get spread out. Just understand that you can be more efficient and dialed in with your local partners and relationships when you stick in one area versus having to go build those relationships in every single area. That's really the main difference.
That makes sense. What about, with Dan and Claudia, we looked at their Tampa properties and they have these amazing high-end, great properties, right? But then it almost seemed like for a little bit, a short period of time, it almost seemed like it kind of cannibalized on itself a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that going to be like a normal thing, or do you think – Or is that like a big risk, or do you think that'll level out? What are your thoughts on
that? So one, you have to look at the demand in the area, right? How much money is the consumer spending? Is there room for multiple properties? Now, they launched properties that are very similar, you know, very top end of the market. And so a brand new property comes out, a lot of times it's a little bit cheaper price. So that one's going to book out before the one that's number one in the market that is booking out. So it can affect the performance, but it's very short term, right? It's very short-lived. So not something you want to worry about too much, but during that launch phase of a new property that's going to compete directly with one of your other properties, it can give that other property maybe a little bit of a hiccup. But if the market's large enough, which you should be doing that research, is there room for both of you to make the same kind of money that property number one's making when I add property number two, right? In this case, in their example, the answer was yes, there is, right? This is a major market, lots of money being spent. You know, there's 11,000 homes in that market. For them to have 4 of the top 11,000, that's pretty, there's a lot of money in that market. But yeah, they've figured out what works in that market. So they're just doubling down. It can, because there's such they're literally, their comp set is their other homes. Like, they're very direct competitors.
Right.
One of them's right next door to each other, right? Mm. Same exact proximity, same exact floor plan. And they both do really, really well. But when the one launched, it does kind of affect and cannibalize that other one for a very short period of time. But it's something that can be happen and you need to consider.
Okay. I love it. Let's go on to our next thing. Why do some people not scale? Like, have you noticed that there's, you know, maybe a mental struggle with something, you know, they have, you talked about the man, what is it called? The
emotional cycle of change.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. The emotion. Do you think people maybe get to the end of it, right? And they've conquered their first short-term rental and then they're kind of, they want to relax a little bit, or have you realized?
A little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
So we all buy properties for different reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Some of us are wanting to build a producing portfolio that gives us true lifestyle financial freedom. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen with one property. So we have to be able to scale. We have to be able to double down. Other people are saying, hey, listen, I want to maybe diversify some of my investments. I might be interested in a lifestyle asset. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really looking to get more than one property. Mm-hmm. And then there's those people in the middle that you're kind of talking about saying, yeah, I do want to scale. Mm-hmm. I went through property number one and it's really hard. Yeah. And I think the grass might be greener somewhere else. Mm. And so they start to look at other investments. That's the most natural thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And it happens everywhere. If you started with multifamily, the first multifamily deal you did, you might think the grass is greener in short-term rentals, right? And then so you really have to choose and say, hey, listen, what are my property goals? What am I really trying to build? Mm. And what am I willing to endure to get that? Mm. And that last question is something that not a lot of people ask themselves. It's like, hey, what am I actually willing to endure when it comes to time, when it comes to money, when it comes to, like, you know, figuring out how, like, what knowledge I need to leverage and how to leverage it, whether I'm going to build it myself, whether I'm going to leverage somebody else's. And so that when you're going through that process, you're like, okay, you know, this is actually harder than I said I was willing to do. Maybe I'm going to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I can promise you, though, everything's hard, right? Yeah. Everything's really hard, especially when you're building a life that you don't have right now, right? Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to scaling, you got to look in the mirror and say, listen, I don't have this life that I say I want. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be tough to get there. I'm going to have to make some changes. I'm going to have to make some sacrifices. I'm going to have to endure some, you know, nights and of, you know, stressed out and rolling up my sleeves and putting in the work. And that happens to be in short-term rentals or anything else. And so I think a lot of times people don't scale, whether it's short-term rentals, whether it's long-term rentals, whether it's multifamily, whether it's commercial property, whatever it is, a lot of times they don't scale because they do the first one and it was harder than they thought it was. And they don't look and say, yeah, but it's okay. I'm okay. I'm still getting closer to my goals. So I'm willing to endure some more of that work, some more of that effort. The gap between property number one and property number two is the longest gap when you're scaling anything.
Time-wise.
Okay. But also because usually when you start to think about investing in something, it's let's keep it at short-term rentals. I've got some money in the bank. Okay. I might have a HELOC. I might have some investment account money. And I say, you know what? I'm interested in putting this into play somewhere else, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've got this capital that I'm looking to place and get a leverage return somewhere. So I decide I want to go into short-term rentals. I buy my first short-term rental. Maybe it's producing and everything else. Mm-hmm. And then even if I say, hey, listen, I'm ready for property number two, but I don't know how I'm going to save up for property number two. So between property number one and two, the reason I say that's the hardest purchase is not property number one. Your hardest purchase is property number two, because most people don't start from zero when they're thinking about property number one. Many times we use all of our capital to go into property number one and we're starting from zero to get to property number two. That's where understanding how to leverage the tax advantages, the cash flow from the property and everything else, so that you don't have to come up with that entire amount for property number two. But it's still going to be the hardest gap to fill time-wise, effort-wise, everything else, because in your mind, you're saying, how am I ever going to get there?
Right.
And the big, beautiful bill that brought back 100% bonus depreciation gave all of us short-term rental investors a massive, massive boost to accelerate the scalability of our portfolio.
Wow.
Lots to digest, right?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think that, okay, so once you get to two, does the time just kind of get shorter and shorter for each one?
Yeah. What you will find, property number one, we're going to buy it. Then that gap between one and two is the largest. And on, then two to three starts to shrink a little bit. Three to four starts to shrink even more. And usually what we see, if you're buying quality assets and quality areas that are cash flowing and you're able to take advantage of all these different things that short-term rentals offer us, usually there's a tipping point between property number three and property number four, where what that means is your portfolio, your investment portfolio account has enough money to fund the next acquisition, and you're not having to save up and skimp and bring money from your active income. And so that's what we, the ultimate goal is to get to that part in your portfolio building process that you say, okay, now I can fund the next one from my existing portfolio. Depending on the market, depending on where you're at, usually between three and four properties, you're going to be able to start to make, you know, you're going to use that portfolio to fund the next purchase.
Okay, so we talked about now the saving of time over time as you as you do this. What about the amount of work involved in each? The first one takes a lot of work. Is it the same amount of work for two, three, four, and five? Or do you learn to kind of pass some of that stuff off? Or what is the
Well, there's a whenever you start to do something more than once, there's a level of competency that you're starting to build, right? We're starting to say, hey, listen, I'm learning the game. I've figured this out. Yeah, this process is pretty dialed in. I don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time. I've done it now. I know some of the problems that I had the first time or the second time, and I'm not going to do it on the third one. And you get more and more efficient. Your competency and your skill sets begin to build. And so as you get more efficient, it's more of just, hey, listen, I'm just going to, I'm plugging right into a process that we know works. And you also have the confidence to dive into it because now you have some validation of whether it's working or not. And so you can double down on what's working and you can make the adjustments on the things that you might have done that are not working.
I love it. Okay. Now, what about the thought process for someone who thinks, you know, I got my first one and I'm just going to maximize this thing to the fullest extent. I'm going to try and wring this thing dry. Is that still a good thought process or should your goal be to scale?
Both.
I mean, your target, I mean, whatever your goals are, of course.
But so like, if you're trying to scale, what I always tell people is maximize what you have first. Let's get that thing to operate at its fullest potential before we consider the next purchase. And we want it set up and to be in a position to maximize its potential, whether that's, you know, on all fronts, revenue wise, you know, some properties I can have some value add, I can actually force some appreciation and I can get some built in equity by doing certain things to certain properties. Not every property lends itself to that, but I'm going to try to maximize what I already own to its fullest potential before I move on to the next one. Because what happens is you will never go back. It's very, it's, and I shouldn't say never, but it's rare that people go back and revitalize struggling properties and they want to move on or they want to scale for that next one. I'm always a big believer that you need to maximize the assets that you have in your portfolio before you move on to that next one.
Okay, well, that made me think of something. Say we're on property four. Right? Yeah. We've gone, we're scaling, we're doing great. Properties four is great. It's been some years now. Property one is kind of struggling a little bit. It needs to be revitalized. Would you say cut off that limb, sell that bad boy, and roll it into the next one, or just revamp it?
It depends.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Just like everybody else that wants to just give a definite answer, I don't. I'm saying you're going to look at it individually. Usually, there's going to be a point, not usually, there's always going to be a point where you're going to get, you got to look at your return on equity. There's going to be a certain point in time where your return on equity goes down, right? And so you're better off sometimes selling these properties rather than maximizing them. So other times you might say, hey, listen, I'm better off maximizing this asset and reinvesting, raising the bar and getting more cash flow coming in, getting better, maybe some appreciation. And so there, you know, cause you don't like, depending on the market, you might be leaving a significant amount of money. And now all of a sudden my return on equity goes up significantly by reinvesting in that property. Other properties, your return on equity is diminishing. We have a property that our return on investment was phenomenal. We were cash flowing almost 100% of our investment every single year. We're getting more than 100% cash on cash return. We own this property for almost 8 years. Mm-hmm. And so it was to the point where we were saying, hey, listen, it's, you know, we're getting a really, really good, and we have gotten a really good return on our investment, mm-hmm. but we're parking so much equity in there. If I actually got my return on that equity, mm-hmm. it wasn't that good. And so I was better off, and we had already maximized it. We're already the number one property in that market. We're already clipping away at the top of the market. We're much better off selling that and placing it into a bigger or better market, mm-hmm. where we have better upside potential, so I can get a better return on that equity, mm-hmm. right? My basis was so low. The numbers I had in that property were so low, mm-hmm. that I was getting a great return on my investment. Mm-hmm. My ROI was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Like over an 8 year period, we had almost a 3,000% ROI. I mean, it was crazy, but over appreciation and cash flow and everything else. Mm-hmm. But if I was looking at my return on equity, I was getting a like 10%, mm-hmm. 11% return on my equity. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, I could place that money somewhere else and get a much better return on that money. Mm. So usually that, when I say every property, a lot of times is going to hit that, because properties go up in value, income goes up. Some markets you're going to start to hit the top side of that market. You're going to start to say, man, I'm already really juicing this for as much revenue as the market is willing to pay for these types of properties. So I'm better off going somewhere else. You might be in a market where there's still a lot of upside potential on revenue, and I'm better off keeping it here. My basis is low, doubling down and getting even a better than 100% ROI or cash on cash return based on what we have in that property. But we're selling a really good property for us. Our basis was low, our money in was low. We already had maximized it about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. We had already done a revamp on the property, mm-hmm. and it was crushing it. Yeah. On paper, it's absolutely crushing it. Mm-hmm. And we could just ride that into the sunset. But when you look at it, you're like, oh man, I know what I could do with that equity, and I could place it into a bigger and better market and get probably double my return instead of sitting on a 10 or 11% return on my equity. I could probably turn that into a 20%+ return on equity, right?
Wow. I mean, that seems like you got to be a really disciplined, experienced investor. Or that seems like a would be a normal trap that people fall into. Like, if you're saying, I've been into this for 8 years, that means you're emotionally invested. You see great ROI on it. So now there's even a little bit more emotional investment into it. So it seems like, is that like a common trap people will fall into? They look at these other things, but don't look at the equity.
I think that is, and more people are talking about your return on equity, mm-hmm. and what you really should be looking to maybe possibly trade up out of these properties. It's very common, you know, any seasoned investor is always looking at that. Okay. We're always looking at our return on equity. Mm-hmm. Normally, we trade up properties about every 5 years on average. It's going to be about a 5 year regular trade up. Sometimes if you have any sort of a value add property, mm-hmm. it's probably going to be less than that. You're probably 3 years, 2.5, 3 years, because you have so much equity and forced appreciation with that value add. Mm-hmm. That would be like a rehab project or something that I did that made that property worth more money, not just based on the regular appreciation, right? So that's going to accelerate that equity that I have in there, and which means I've got to consider, is it best parked in this property or is it best parked somewhere else? Sometimes it is best staying in that property. Other times it's not. When you're investing, there's always things that we're looking at. Here's the things that we're trying to identify, but there's not a rule of thumb of sell after this amount of time or always trade up after a certain, certain period. Mm-hmm. It's market by market, property by property specific. Mm-hmm. Wow. And it goes back to our property goals.
Wow. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And say, what if it's a legacy property? You don't want to sell legacy properties. You want to keep those properties, even though you might get a better return on, your equity somewhere else. Mm-hmm. That might not be your property goals. Your property goals might say, hey, listen, I want 5 properties and I want them in these markets because we want these as legacy properties for our family in our portfolio forever. They're producing great. They're maximized, but I'm not always looking at my return on equity. Mm-hmm. If I'm a true investor trying to scale and get the best return of the money I have invested, that's when you look at that. And a lot of investors look at that. A lot of new investors might not have heard about it. Luckily, we're fortunate more and more people are talking about that, because I think sometimes when you do this for a long time, you assume that everybody is looking at those things, and they're not always.
Okay, good to know. Let's go in. We have just a couple more things. Here we go. Self-managing. Say you self-manage, right? Is this going to be something that's going to kind of hinder you from scaling because you're already taking so much time responding to guests and handling so many things to your first property that you may not want to take on that burden? Like, is it easier to have a PM before you scale?
Well, it's always easier to have right. somebody do it for you, right? Yeah. Is that the right choice? Maybe, maybe not. Okay. I have property managers on every one of my properties. Mm-hmm. We have some of our top members who self-manage and mm-hmm. they manage their own properties. Mm-hmm. It is much easier because management for sure has economies of scale, which means if having multiple properties in the same location or mm-hmm. the same vicinity makes it much easier to manage the properties.
Like if you're a self-manager.
Yeah, if you're self-managing and you're trying to scale a portfolio mm-hmm. and you choose that, many times a lot of our members who self-manage will choose to stay in that same area. They know it. Mm-hmm. They've got the cleaners. They've got the handyman. They understand who their team members are, right. and they build very nice little businesses in those areas as they begin to scale.
Right.
Other members, myself included, are mm-hmm. going to say, hey, listen, we use property managers. We're going to hire the best property manager to help us maximize these assets. It allows us to go to other properties. I don't have to focus on any mm-hmm. sort of the communication, guest communication, any mm-hmm. interaction, all of that stuff. So it does free up our time, right? But you also, it costs me to do that, right? Mm-hmm. I have to pay somebody to do that. If you self-manage, you're kind of earning that, right? Mm-hmm. You're trading some of that extra effort for a little bit of extra income, especially mm-hmm. when it comes to management, which is going to be your largest expense if you don't manage your own properties.
Mm. Okay, here we go. Now give us a realistic timeline. You said 1 to 2 is the longest, 2 to 3, then 3 to 4 tipping point. Is this 5 year, 10 yeah. year run? What does this look like?
Yeah. So we have 5 years to freedom. Mm-hmm. And the concept of 5 years to freedom is every single year we're going to buy a property mm-hmm. and we're going to rinse and repeat the same situation. Mm-hmm. Now we are going to use the best and fastest way to scale is assuming that you use those tax advantages, bonus depreciate, materially right. participate. It puts a lot more money in your pocket and it's a massive amount of leverage to accelerate. However, it doesn't, if I do 5 years to freedom and my goal is to have one property every single year for 5 years, I might have an 18-month gap between 1 and 2. I might have a 24-month gap between 1 and 2. And then the next gap between 2 and 3 might be 18 months. And then 3 to 4 might be 8 months, right? Mm-hmm. And then 6 months or 3 months, right? All of right. a sudden, it starts to go faster toward the end. Mm. So you have to say, okay, what do I want this portfolio to look like? Am I okay? What if it's not one property every single year for 5 years? What if it's one property every year for every other year for 10 years, right? Are we okay with that? Does that work for us? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is yeah, you go after it. You just are kind of putting together your time horizon. And here's how you can do it.
Okay.
This is going to take just a minute, so we might get a little long-winded. But let's say I buy a $500,000 property and I get my cash flow, I get my appreciation, I get my note pay down, and I get my tax advantages, mm-hmm. right? So cash flow and tax advantages stay in my pocket. Note pay down, appreciation stay in the property, and I don't realize that until I sell it. What stays in my pocket, then I can use to go buy property number two. So if I buy, and I'm just going to go quickly through the numbers, $500,000 property, I put $100,000 in, okay? And that $100,000 is going to get me into that $500,000 property, and then I get 5% appreciation. So I got 25 grand in equity staying in the property. I can't touch that. I get about $5,000 in note pay down, stays in the property. So I got a nice 30% return baked into just the property every single year. Mm-hmm. And then I get cash flow. Let's say I only get 5% cash on cash return. So I have $5,000 in my pocket. Mm-hmm. That stays. I can use that. I can throw that in my investment bank account. So when I go start property number two, now I've got $5,000 sitting in that investment bank account. Mm-hmm. Where you can accelerate it is to say, okay, based on your average cost segregation study that's going to come out, it's going to be between 25 and 35% of the acquisition cost in most cases on single family homes. It's not, it very much depends, but it's going to be somewhere close to that mm-hmm. on single family homes. Let's say it's on the low side and it's 25% of the $500,000. So I'm going to get a write-off that I get to take to the IRS of $125,000. That write-off, for those of the people that are in that 30% tax bracket, you're keeping $40,000 that you don't have to pay the IRS from buying that property. So that 40 grand, if you've already paid it, you get it back. If you haven't paid it, it stays in your pocket. So it's money you would already pay, assuming you're making more than $125,000, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to get that $125,000 write-off is going to reduce your taxes by 40K-ish, wow. Right? Wow. So now on property number two, I've got the $5,000 that I got from cash flow, and I got the $40,000 that I didn't have to pay Uncle Sam by buying that property. So now instead of having to save up the whole $100,000, I've got $45,000 sitting there. So I have to figure out how to save up $55,000. So if you're in that scenario, you have to say, okay, how long is it going to take me to save up the 55K? Right? Mm-hmm. Do I have it available? Do I have to, disposable income that I can start to put into my investment bank account so that I can go rinse or repeat? That might be 18 months from now. Maybe it's 2 years for you to save up that 55K. And then I rinse or repeat and I do it again. And then the next time I do it, same scenario. I have now, but now I've got the tax savings and I've got two properties producing. Property one also, right. Now you have to remember these properties right. typically take about 12 to 18 months to hit their kind of optimize and maximize. And so normally we're looking for more than a 5% cash on cash return by the time we optimize and maximize these properties. Mm-hmm. So now let's just assume in our regular scenario that we're getting a 10% cash on cash return now that we're optimized on property number one. So now, for property number two to three, I have the same tax savings. Let's assume I bought the exact same rinse or repeat. I got 40 grand in my tax savings on my investment account. I got 5K from cash flow from property number two. So I'm at 45K. Mm-hmm. And now I've got 10K from property number one that I can go put back into that property. Right. And right. So now I've got 55K instead of 45. So now instead of saving up 55, I need to come up with 45. Mm-hmm. I rinse or repeat and it's going to keep going down. And then so by now, property number three, I'm going to be coming in. I've got 10,000, 10,000, 5,000. So I got 25,000 plus my 40. So now I got 65K. Mm. Now I only have to come up with 35, right? Mm. So you get to reduce the amount you're coming up with every single time. Mm. If you're in a position where it took you 18 months to save up from one to two to save up the 55K, then all of a sudden, the next one might take me 12 months, might take me 8 months, whatever it is. And you start to reduce that timeline between each of those properties. Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. I'm totally with you. What about someone that wants to just go ahead and get two properties? Let's just go ahead and get two.
Yeah.
The combo deal. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. If it's instead that I can have two already doing that, they can cost seg both out of and pull stuff from. Do people ever do that?
Yeah, if they have the capital,
yeah,
100%. And so one of the biggest questions is somebody with a decent amount of capital to start with that can buy multiple properties, they say, should I buy one property or two properties? Mm-hmm. Ideally, one property is easier, right? Mm-hmm. If you can get the same returns on one bigger property in a bigger and better market, a lot of times that's the play. Okay. Not always though. You might be better off and you might have, you might be wanting to get into a certain market and you have X amount of dollars to place. This happens all the time. Somebody's like, I want to have a property here and they're trying to place more than that market really will bear. Mm. So you might be in some markets, it's hard to place $1 million. Mm. Other markets, you can't even play unless you have $1 million, right? And so it's very dependent on the market itself. Yeah. And if you're very specific about the market, many times you got to buy multiple smaller properties. Mm. But if you're not and you're open to bigger and better properties, a lot of times your opportunity, because it's easier to take care of one roof. It's easier to have, one furnace to deal with, if something goes wrong, like your capital expenses on one property, it's just less things that can go wrong, right. Less things that can happen. And so, there's fewer guests that you're dealing with. And so if I can maximize my dollars and I have the revenue potential and it's going to meet my property goals, it's easier to place it in one big property versus two smaller ones.
Okay. All right, now I completely blanked and forgot to bring this up, but I want to kind of end on this article, then we'll go into the speed round questions. I saw this article literally as I'm creating this, I looked up, and this is the article that came out. Let's see here. Just the other day, scaling short-term rentals is harder than the industry admits.
Yeah.
When people read headlines like that, I mean, do you kind of want them to agree with that?
Yes.
Okay.
I do.
Okay.
It is harder.
Okay.
I mean, it is. The scenario I just laid out,
yeah.
It's not easy. Mm-hmm. There's a reason not everybody's financially free though either, right? So if it was easy, we would all be financially free. Mm-hmm. Everybody would be. Mm-hmm. And so the, 100% the, you know, when I see those articles, now I haven't read that article. I don't know why they're saying it's harder, but in general, look on Instagram and look on, you know, YouTube and on TikTok or wherever you get your source of information, it looks pretty damn easy, right? Yeah. And so it is made to look super easy to pull off. And, you know, we always, like, everybody wants the view, nobody wants the climb scenario, and nobody talks about the climb. And so I would agree, it is harder. What I just talked about, property one to two, it's hard to come up and figure out, how am I going to do this? How am I going to get from, you know, point A to point B? And then I do it twice. And then I'm like, okay, my competency level, my skill sets are getting better. From two to three, it's a little bit easier, but I'm still putting in work. All those different times I'm saying, hey, listen, you're coming up and saving up X amount. And then next year it's a little bit less, but you're still having to dive in. And then you still have to do the work every single time, right? And so these properties, the reason I don't manage my own properties, because by the time I have my portfolio built, they are very passive investments for me, the way that I set stuff up. And so I do want to create a passive investment, but scaling, when you're in the middle of scaling and you're in the middle of acquisition, you're in the middle of setup, it's intense. And there is more work than people let on and are led to believe.
Wow. I love that. Okay. All right. Let's go into our speed round questions, huh?
All right. Let's do it.
35 minutes in. This is a great time for some speed rounds. I got seven of them here. Okay.
All right.
What has to be true before someone should even think about scaling?
You better have your what you already own maximized.
Okay.
And then ultimately making sure that you're in a financial position and a time position to do it.
I think you already answered this question, but you already answered. Is there a number of properties where scaling actually gets easier?
Yeah. 3 to 4.
3 to 4. Yeah. What matters more for scaling? The quality of the deal or operating at the highest level?
I don't know what you're asking there.
Like if I want to scale to my second property, is it better to find a deal that's maybe the house is cheaper and the interest rate is lower, or is it better to operate my first property or that property and maximize it?
Maximize. I'm always a fan of maximizing. Okay. Right. So you maximize by basically finding quality deals, quality markets. Oh, okay. Quality locations, right? Yeah.
Okay.
You know, we always say quality properties in quality areas. Mm-hmm. And then that allows us to maximize, right? So we're always looking to maximize as we scale. Maximize. This is a game where, like we said, you don't have to have 100 doors. In fact, you don't want 100 doors. You're much better off with a smaller, high producing portfolio that starts with the quality deals, that starts with the quality markets.
Okay. All right, what's the biggest warning sign that a property does not belong in a scalable portfolio?
Well, it goes back to the markets. Like when we were doing our boardroom HQ on Friday, we were talking about acquisition.
Right.
And we were looking at, there's a lot of people looking for their first property and a lot of people there looking for their second or third property. And we were analyzing markets. And when we start to look at these markets where the average acquisition price versus the revenue, that ratio is not favorable, it's not going to be a good property to put into a scalable portfolio.
Okay. Right. So maybe the market, not the property.
Yeah. It's the market potential. And then obviously finding those properties that can fit within that potential. There's always outliers and properties. Like what did I talk about on Friday? I said, listen, you have to get, what we're doing is we're going to create a very specific buy box. And our buy box is going to be so specific that we're going to be saying no to 80 to 90% of properties. And so it's understanding that most properties probably are not going to fit into your buy box. And you have to be okay with that, right? And so it does have to do with the property. So it's first and foremost market. Second, you're saying no to a whole bunch of properties because they don't all fit. And so it's understanding what are all of those criteria that allow us to be very specific about what we're looking for, a very specific buy box, so that we know the ones to say, yeah, I'm not scaling with that one. I'm not scaling with that one. So it's first market, then it's property.
Okay. What expense feels painful at first, but becomes a non-negotiable when scaling?
A lot of buyers don't feel this expense, but I see resistance toward it, is your realtor partner.
Wow, I was not expecting that.
So your realtor partner is, especially if you're not in a local area, like if you're not in that area, that local knowledge from a good realtor is invaluable. And it costs money, right? And so there's money that, like, I don't buy any properties. Like, I have a, I own a brokerage in Utah and had for years. I had my license for years. I don't anymore, but Teresa still does. And we have, I mean, we know how to sell houses. We've sold a lot of houses. We've written a lot of contracts. We know how to negotiate deals. I still hire a realtor every single market and every single deal I go into because I want to know the nuances of the market. And I don't think people, especially new investors, as they're scaling, put enough value on that information to be able to, and because we're talking about locations and we're talking about micro locations in markets and we're talking about properties. Your realtor partners can be really, really valuable in understanding those local the local nuances in a market and that local knowledge that you're going to have a hard time understanding unless it's right in your backyard.
Okay, that's interesting. I wasn't expecting that one. How does scaling change the way you think about risk?
So scaling, when you start to understand the scaling, the possibilities with scaling a portfolio, like it starts to not feel as risky, right? Because when I buy my first property, you most people, you're not retiring on your first property. In fact, you can a lot of times your first year, you're taking that property and you're running the numbers in your head and you're saying, man, I heard Sean talk about five properties and being financially free. Or Dan and Claudia, we just in Tampa, they only have four property portfolio. They're completely financially free. And a lot of times we just calculate forward that one property and say, I'm never going to be financially free, right? Times this by five, it doesn't work, right? That's not necessarily how the game is played and how it works. And so when you start to understand scaling and we start to write down all of those levers that we can pull and then the capital in and then being able to do it the second time and the third time and we write it out on a piece of paper, when you start to understand scale, you start to realize the risk is in not scaling. Not, you know, the risk is sitting on one property. Unless you're literally just trying to supplement a lifestyle asset, it's a lot riskier to just sit, and it's more expensive, takes more time, more money, your returns aren't as good when you only have the one property. When you start to scale and you have a really quality portfolio of a handful of properties, it can make a massive difference. And it's hard to understand that until you really write it out and fast forward what that actually looks like and means and what that can mean over a 5 or 10 year time horizon.
Okay, now you may have kind of just answered this next one. What's the clearest sign someone is ready to scale but they don't realize it yet?
If the property is maximized, it's making them money, it's going into an investment bank account, they're still earning their active income and they're still building that investment bank account up. There's, you know, you're clearly in a financial position to do it. You've clearly learned on property number one what it takes to succeed. So they're like, okay, do they actually realize that by going to property number two, property number three, property number four, and building this, what that really looks like for them? And I think I would challenge everybody listening to write that stuff out and decide, like, what does a five property portfolio look like based on the types of properties that I might already have in my portfolio and based on, or if I'm looking at properties, based on the capital I have available and what that's going to look like to do that five times.
Okay. A lot of this to me seems like knowing your numbers, knowing the
it's all numbers, right? Yeah. It's all data, right? Yeah. You're looking at and understanding your numbers. It's understanding your own personal financial situation. Like, where are you going to be pulling money from? Where are you going to be giving up and sacrificing to not buy something so that it can continue to build that investment portfolio so you can start to double down? And where are you getting your returns, right? Are you really calculating returns and comparing apples to apples against other investments and other, you know, other types of real estate, other types of securities types investments, stock portfolios, all those different things are understanding where are all those investment levers pulled and how can you leverage the resources you have to get the maximum return?
Yeah.
And a lot of times that has to do with scaling. Anything, like, right? Any type of a portfolio. You have to scale in order to get those maximum returns. There's sacrifices when it comes to scaling, and there's also rules to follow and blueprints and recipes for success in whatever game you're going to play, short-term rentals being no exception.
Yeah. I mean, everything is going to take work. Everything's going to have its quote unquote risk, or you're going to have to really, you know, dive into it. But
and there's a lot of portfolios we look at that are 5 to 8 property portfolios that don't do very well. And so it's not, don't get me or misunderstand me when I say, you know, 4 to 5 properties is going to set you up. It's 4 to 5 of the right properties in the right market that has the potential to meet your property goals. And that's where most people mess up right from the start. They don't even have the right properties in the right markets to even set themselves up. It doesn't matter whether you rinse and repeat that 20 times, you're probably not hitting your property goals in many cases. And so understanding all of it from the very beginning, property goals, what resources I have, ultimately what markets and properties can help me reach those goals the fastest. And then I start scaling into it.
I love it. Contact us if you want to, we want some help on this.
Yeah. If you have questions on it and you want to write it out, I mean, I'll always send those questions into support@odyssey.com. We love seeing them come through and love answering them on the podcast for those of you that are avid listeners, and you can get those questions answered.
I'd love it. That's it. That's all we have for today.
That's it. All right. Let's wrap it up, you guys. We always appreciate you spending your time with us at the end of every episode. I always like to thank you for that. It is valuable and we know it, and we appreciate you spending it with us. Our goal, as you know, is to help people walk into this game with their eyes wide open. So always love if you like it, thumbs up on whatever platform you're watching or listening on, and share it with those people that you think might be interested in these conversations. Those things are much appreciated and very helpful for us as we continue to grow this show. And the final, most important thing I ask you at the end of every episode, pick that one thing you can do today, start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends.
Cheers.
Almost choked on vacation there.
Joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Vodacy.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.